Hi, everyone. My name is Natalie Gochner, and this is Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political center and have on the political right, John Dougal.
Hey, great to be with you.
And on the political left, Shireen Gorbani.
Hello, and hey, listeners. Hope you're doing well.
So excited to have a discussion
it's
with the two of you today.
Season.
It's holidays, and, you know, I just get kind of a big picture kind of view this time of year. It's the end of a calendar year. It's the start coming of a new year. And we want to talk this program about the biggest challenges facing the Beehive State and some of the biggest opportunities. That sound good?
Certainly.
Okay. You guys feel free to weigh in here. You know, you're tempted when you talk about biggest challenges to go straight to housing affordability.
So we're not going to go housing for 500?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, how do you set this up? Because it's so evident to people. But I was in front of a group this weekend, and I reminded them that we have, it changes quarter to quarter. But right now we have the 10th most expensive housing market in the country. And since
there's no way that most people hear that housing is expensive, but 10th most. When you start thinking San Francisco and L.A. and Seattle.
Yeah. And then if you look at the price appreciation, it's gone up more in Utah since the 1990s than any state in the country. Now, this is partly our success.
Right.
You know, because we've become a magnet state. People are moving here. There's a lot of demand for housing. But Shireen, this is one of our biggest challenges.
Yeah, this is certainly one of our biggest challenges. It was one of the biggest challenges when I was on the county council. And it was also, I would say, the biggest source of contention. And I think maybe the reason I lost when I ran again. But I will say that the experience that I had approving housing at the county level was something that I was hearing from Republican colleagues on county commissions across the state. The reticence that people have to want to see housing go into open spaces, but also the thing that will always stick with me is standing. I was out in a community feedback opportunity in Riverton, and that's where near the area where we were approving additional housing. And I asked this woman, you know, tell me about your family. Like, what's going on? And she's like, oh, my kids live in my basement because they can't afford a home. Mm. And I'm like, so you're living the problem. You're living the problem, but you don't want to see the solution.
Yeah.
So I think we're going to struggle ongoing. And I struggle with it in Salt Lake City. A lot of NIMBYism, not in my backyard. But then also, I think a real understanding that housing is, I would say, just one of the essential, if not the essential piece for stability and wealth building for families.
John, you have to, I think, agree that NIMBYism isn't a Republican or Democrat issue.
NIMBY meaning not in my backyard.
Yeah. It's
It's a human nature.
It's a human nature. And I used to tell people that it's a fear of losing something that's valuable to you. A sense of loss is what makes people become NIMBYs.
Well, in two senses of loss. There's a concern of I'm going to lose something financially in terms of the value of my home because we have created a society in which for the overwhelming majority of homeowners, their wealth is in their home, not in other assets. So you've got that at play. And then loss in sense of the sense of community. This was a small town and now it's not kind of rural. It's now a suburb or it's become urban or whatever it might be. And it's bringing outsiders that don't necessarily think the way I think or believe the way I think or have different political leanings or whatever it might be. And so there's this fear culturally that something's going to change.
Yeah. Well, this one's going to be with us for a while. I don't predict that we're going to figure this out anytime soon. And I would just remind listeners that it's not just about getting more supply, even though that's a big deal. We need less NIMBYism, more choice, more different product offerings, dare I say it, higher densities. But we also need to work on it from the side of educating people and giving them more gainful employment so they have higher incomes and can afford housing.
So true. Incredibly
you like that.
True.
I'm glad you do, Shireen.
I like
Shireen.
That. I think it's critical. I think it's also, to me, that becomes a gender issue. Right. When we think about how Utah continues to show up on the list of the worst places to be a woman in the United States, one of the driving factors is the pay disparity. And I think about, well, if we want to, you know, help families cross that threshold, one thing that we could be doing is focusing on pay equity. One thing of many.
Well, this is one of those things. It's kind of this chicken egg. I mean, pay goes up, more demand for housing, price of housing goes up, pay goes up. Price of housing goes up. It just keeps.
Yeah.
I mean, I watched this in the Bay Area where I used to live for 5 years, and I thought it was expensive when I lived there in the early 90s. It's only become much worse since then. But it's just you're continually chasing this thing. And as you mentioned, you know, this is partly the result of successes that we've had economically in Utah, that the demand for housing, the price for housing has gone up. But one of the other things I would argue is we have to be clear about what are your property rights? what can you do with your property? Because mm-hmm. we're kind of squishy, loosey-goosey. Can I replace my home with a fourplex condo? Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. no, unless maybe I get the votes on the council or, gee, this happens or that happens. And so there's a lot of uncertainty with what can I and what can't I do
yeah,
with my property.
Tricky issue. This is a little bit related to it, but at least to the point of trying to get more gainful employment. But one of my other biggest challenges is third grade reading proficiency in our state. I'll go to you first on this, John. You're kind of an education guy. We have less than 50% of third graders in our public schools are proficient in reading.
Uh-huh.
And they say that you know, learn to read by third grade, and after third grade, you read to learn. So that's why it's such a vital milepost is you've got to be reading at grade level in third grade.
So why do you think less than half of Utah students at the third grade can read?
What do you think? I mean, I think it's multifaceted. I'm disappointed in what kind of support's coming from home. I also think it's not helpful that we have such large class sizes and haven't focused enough attention on it to have more reading pros in every classroom. I sometimes wonder if we should be graduating, moving them on to fourth grade if they haven't finished, you know, a higher reading proficiency. But you know what my number one solution would be? I think the pandemic didn't help us, and I would extend the school year another 6 weeks and get these kids to third grade proficiency. I'd have school into July in a heartbeat. You
wow.
guys are smiling at
least,
me.
Wow. Least popular person on the show today with
really?
Kids is going to
yes.
be you.
Well, and maybe even teachers.
And maybe even teachers.
But most teachers, you know, have a second income during the summer, and I'm like, yeah. let's. It would cost the state a lot of money to do this, but we need our kids reading.
Well, so I've somewhat joked about this, but I'm being somewhat serious. If reading is so important, why isn't first grade nothing but reading and recess? I mean, we distract a lot of what takes place in first grade with things other than reading.
Yeah.
And I would argue that we have kids sitting in classrooms too much of the day. Why don't we focus, hyper-focus on reading and recess? And you talked about class size. And for a lot of folks, they just think of the regular, we're just cookie cutter, mm-hmm. class size means this. And what I'm describing, you could scale it. So anywhere from a teacher is helping one student to a small group of 3 to 5 students with reading rather than dealing with a class of, you know, let's say 30 students
yeah.
at a time. Because the
a
rest, of them,
in
the rest
room.
Of them are out learning through play. And maybe, but we don't even want to get to talking about different ideas like that. We just see the day, like when we were in school, like, you know, when others before us were in school. And it's, the school day looks an awful lot like it's looked for decades.
Yeah.
And yet we keep saying the importance. I totally agree with you about the importance of reading mm-hmm. because that so controls your learning after that.
Shereen, but, you may know this, but John is a education expert. Do you know that about
him? I know this. And I will say,
particularly in education finance and education policy.
Yeah. This is a place where I think you and I actually have maybe a lot of agreement. I think the way that we think about learning in our schools, especially in the early stages, it deserves a deep dive into understanding if it's meeting the demands of the kind of workforce that we're asking for today. But that crucial piece around reading is essential. And I do think that there could be really good outcomes associated with that. I feel lucky to be raising a reader, to have been raised by a reader, to enjoy and find ease with reading myself. And I think about how many cultural barriers, how many community barriers are set up if you do not have the ability to navigate the world as a proficient reader. I think the other thing that I just always like to put in the ears of our listeners is thinking about the fact, I know this, I'm sure I'll get pushback, but we continue to be the state that is investing the least per student in the nation. Mm-hmm. And I think Wyoming or Idaho is like trying to get pretty close to us or maybe has surpassed us. But when we think about the investment
depends
that
on
we
whether
make,
or not you count building costs in there.
Okay, there we go. So when we think about that, I just caution people when I hear critiques around what is happening with our education system. To me, it's a little bit like somebody setting a house on fire and then saying, why are all these houses on fire, right? Why are these houses on fire? We need to adequately invest. And I do think that it should be around new thinking, around new ways of meeting the demands. But we do need to adequately invest in education.
We should move on. But I also think that we should think about governance in education.
Yes.
And I would totally, this is why I bring up that you're an expert, John, but I would totally be for having a governor appoint our superintendent of education in the state and let the governor be somewhat accountable for educational outcomes.
And this is where you and I would disagree because the governor has such a large portfolio. And I'm not talking about the current governor. I'm talking about the history of governors. Mm-hmm. And therefore, they're not really accountable for anything because there's so much on there. I like what the governor did on roads, so I'm going to give him a pass when it comes to healthcare or whatever it might be. And I would rather have a state superintendent that's elected by the people, and they have to stand in front of the people and be accountable on that single topic. But I would really push for decentralization and really empower parents to collaborate with teachers to look for the learning needs of each student. I don't imagine that the state board or the legislature as a super school board can really dictate and manage education as they like to say over the years.
Yeah.
It really needs to get down where the rubber meets the road. I would also love to see us get more volunteers.
Yeah.
We've got lots of retirees that would probably be more than happy to volunteer in the classroom.
Those are good points. Hey, let's do one more. Mental health. What do you want to say about mental health? And let's do youth mental health. Yeah. This is a scourge in our state. This is all these different measures of behavioral health. They're all trending in the wrong direction.
And is it trending in the wrong direction because we're measuring it more than we ever did before? Or is there something that is going amiss?
There's something that's going amiss, and I'm holding it in my hand. It's our phones. It's the great rewiring. It's this generation of kids that grew up staring at their phones and having different ideas about their self-image and about their engagement with others coming through electronics rather than face-to-face. That's my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, and unfortunately, we lived in a state that already had a desperately sad high rate of suicide. We've had a lot of struggles around mental health in the Intermountain West generally, right? Mm-hmm. And huge and available access to guns. So often these two combine for really awful outcomes. But I think I'll say, yes, I'm really concerned about what's happening with children. I also spent last night down at my local church inviting folks in off the streets to have a night out of the cold. And I think we all understand and know, but that overlap of housing, education, domestic violence or sexual violence, and mental health really creates a free fall for some folks. And there's a lot more we could be
John,
doing.
John, let's get you, and then we'll take a short break.
I would argue, my concern is, I think I saw some of the issues with mental health before phones were really, you know, systematic with present with kids. And so I think maybe phones clearly aren't improving the situation. But I think there was something kind of before we had the cell phones as present that was impacting mental health. And I'm disturbed by that, but I don't know what.
Yeah, if you read one book on this, read the book, The Anxious Generation by Jonathan Haidt. And he rocks through the great rewiring and then the correlation with mental health indicators going awry. Let's take a short break. And Natalie Gochner with Shereen Gourbani and John Dougal. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on UPR. We'd love to hear from our listeners like you. If you'd like to send us a comment, email bsotapodcast@gmail.com. Once again, that's bsotapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Shereen Gourbani on the left.
John Dougal on the right.
Natalie Gochner in the Political Center. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. We've been talking about biggest challenges. We're also, in this segment, going to talk about biggest opportunities facing our state. John, Shereen, do you guys have a biggest challenge you want to throw out there?
Well, something I think if listeners know much about me, they know I'm pretty concerned around healthcare.
And never would have guessed.
I know. And
here it comes, John, one more time.
Certainly particularly focused on reproductive health care, but largely I'm very concerned about what's going to happen. I had the opportunity recently to spend some time in southern Utah down around in Wayne County, passing the community health center there. Of course, they have a big sign that caught my attention because it said health care for all. And what they mean is they take Medicaid patients. They'll take people who may not have other ways of paying for it. The population that this state has seen already increase in terms of the uninsured is by tens of thousands since the Medicaid unwinding after COVID. And that number is only set to increase. When we think about the billionaire bailout bill that was passed and supported by our members of Congress, more and more Utahns are going to be faced with a decision of whether or not they can afford their health care. They're probably thinking about this right now if they're on the ACA. And what that does to our overall health system and, frankly, the strain that it puts on families is top of mind for me.
Shereen is like being on the Sunday morning talk shows, John, where she's got this billion-dollar...
The billionaire bailout.
Bailout.
It just rolls off her tongue.
They did get a lot of money.
Practice it.
They got a lot of money.
She's got three Bs going. Billionaire bailout bill.
Because it wasn't big and it wasn't beautiful unless you're a billionaire, honestly. And I'll just add that I think this is something that, you know, when we think about the intersection of mental health, when we think about stability in housing, when we think about the ability to hold a job, having health care is really essential.
John, what's your challenge?
Well,
you'll
I would
out?
Argue that there's a difference between, quote unquote, health insurance and actually getting care.
Mm-hmm.
And too often we pretend like just because you're insured or supposedly insured, mm-hmm. you can get the care, and a lot of folks can't get the care.
Yeah, it's fair. You got a challenge you want to throw out there, John?
I'm going to do something mundane like energy.
Not mundane. Not mundane.
But if you look, demand for electricity is going up for various reasons. It's an indication, I would suggest, of our economic mobility, economic success. But when we look at new technologies, artificial intelligence, so forth.
Data centers,
they're demanding more. And we're entering this interesting world, which is the data centers are wanting more power, but they're not clear where they're going to locate. So power companies are wanting to grow and expand. And now you're at the risk of being homeowners in local businesses having to bear the cost of building infrastructure mm-hmm. for a data center that might not show up.
Yeah.
Yet we're going to need more and more, and we want it cheap. I mean, we want power that's essentially free.
Yeah.
That's the world we're in. We're seeing increases in Utah, but we're relatively cheap when you look at other states.
Might be the word of 2025, affordability.
Affordability.
Yeah, might be. John, I got a stat for you. I heard Emmy Lesofsky, she's the state energy director, advisor to the governor. She was at a meeting I was at the other day, and she said that an AI search takes 8 to 12 times more energy than a regular Google search.
Google search.
Kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Gives you some perspective.
Natalie, I feel like you're in a particularly interesting seat. You mm-hmm. get to lead an institution mm-hmm. that is interested in providing legislators, the public, with mm-hmm. good information to make strong decisions. So I think you're really the expert when it comes to, you know, what do you think is a big opportunity for us that is also maybe a challenge right now?
Wow.
And
great,
not in my backyard.
Great Salt Lake is a big one
yeah.
for me, right?
Yeah.
I think of Great Salt Lake as got a triple head. It's important to our ecology, it's important to our health, and it's important to our economy. That's our biggest reputational risk.
Yeah.
And I think it's widely misunderstood. I think some of what you see in the popular press is dead wrong.
Okay.
How so? What do you?
Elaborate
a little bit more.
Well, you know, if you follow the data, follow the science, we've got a huge challenge and problem, but we can fix this. This isn't an existential threat yet.
Yet.
Yeah. And this notion that our property values are going to, you know,
plummet
and people are going to have a mass exodus from the Wasatch Front. I don't think that's right.
Yeah. I think I would say, though, the health impacts are already in play and likely to get, you know, worse. Right. But the thing that I feel hopeful about is when you look at the other salt lakes that have collapsed, mm-hmm. I think the attention came a lot later, even though this is not mm-hmm. early. We're not mm-hmm. early.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it does feel like we could do this. I think the thing that breaks my heart about Utah over and over again is that problems that feel within reach of our ability to fix, we miss. I think sometimes we miss. And
yeah.
So I'm desperately hopeful that this is not one of those.
Well, and I'm gonna say that there's a lot of folks that still remember essentially 40 years ago when we had too much water and we were having pumps to pump water out of the Great Salt Lake. And so there's still this element of, oh, it goes in cycles and we're fine and whatever, because they remember that situation where we were coping with too much water versus declining right now.
Here's another one, Shireen, on your list. So Shireen asked this difficult for me because she says, what's the biggest like challenge that could be an opportunity? You know, you were merging them. That makes it tricky. But but if I look at the population growth that's going to happen in Utah County and Wasatch County, that's a huge challenge, but what an opportunity. So in your home county, John, mm-hmm. you're going to get 700,000 more people over the next 4 decades.
Yeah. Yeah. And
that's
pretty soon
a challenge.
We're going to be bigger than Salt Lake County, which is hard for
people.
Yeah,
not in 4 decades.
Not in 4 decades,
but yeah, it's
going to
happen.
Hard for people to think about that.
Yeah. And so that's a challenge, but think what an opportunity it is. If they do this right, and I don't know exactly what that means, but plan the schools, plan the infrastructure, plan the public open space, preserve critical lands, keep some of those orchards, start making decisions that improve your life quality and not just make you a victim of whatever comes your way.
Mm-hmm.
Your quick thoughts there.
Well, I mean, this is akin to, you know, transportation stuff that I worked on a couple decades ago, saying we're going to grow. And why are we just letting people build right up to the roads when we then have to pay to buy them out when we expand and they get irritated and everything.
Point.
Let's, you know,
preserve the corridors,
get the right of way so that as we grow, we can fill that in. We can,
yeah.
And so we've benefited some from that. I would say for schools and stuff, you want to figure out how to build buildings that last a shorter period of time, because it's so hard to close schools and everything else and population mm-hmm. shift. You want to be able to adapt and adjust nimbly.
Yeah,
flexibly.
Fair. Shireen, I don't know how much time you spend up in Heber, Midway, Wasatch County, but these beautiful agricultural lands. And they use that term, you know, you kill the goose that lays the golden egg.
Yeah.
I worry about that in that community. Those people have property rights. They should be able to sell those lands and develop those lands. But there's a public good that comes from the pastoral setting and whatever.
Yeah. I mean, I saw this just recently, right? As I mentioned, I was in Wayne County. The way that some folks have really decided to build that matches the landscape and preserve land, and the way that folks have not, is a challenge.
Yeah.
It really is.
How about...
But you've highlighted, I shouldn't have to be forced to preserve it at my own expense. If the community wants to preserve it, then property rights, they should buy me out.
Yeah. I've got a great example of that, and that's the Oscathorpe Barn in Summit County, Park City, the big white barn as you drive in. You know, that was a property tax increase to buy out the development rights to preserve that land in perpetuity. And therefore, you have all of the cross-country skiing, the view sheds, the culture, the customs.
Beautiful.
Yeah, it's something. And there was a public good to that, and they took it to a vote. I don't know where to go, but we should talk about, when we're talking about opportunities, we should talk about the Olympics and Paralympic Winter Games in 2034.
Okay.
Who wants to lead that?
Oh, not the ones coming this February.
That's Milano Cortez.
Yeah, there you go.
No, Milano Cortina.
Yeah. So I think that there are a couple of exciting things for me here. One is the opportunity to see expansion and investment in transportation. Would love to see us get real creative about thinking about connections east-west, mm-hmm. which continue to be a challenge. And housing.
Kimball Junction.
Yeah.
Fix it.
Yep.
Before the games.
Great example.
That's the intersection up by Park City.
Yeah. So here's one of the key things is, right now we're complaining about the success we've had and impact on housing and so forth. 2034, we're going to tout our state, our communities to the world, which hopefully if we're successful, brings even more demand for coming to Salt Lake. So to your point earlier, our success creates other longer term problems. And I don't think we need a lot of infrastructure for the games.
No surprise.
But it comes post games. Because during the games, this last time during 2002, the roads were like the best to drive ever. I mean, people were staying off the roads and everything. They were staying home. They were scared to death to hit the roads. So we didn't actually need the infrastructure, you know, the roads for the games. But it was what came after the games that you needed it.
I've got an opportunity that I've not spoken publicly about before, and it's still in the real preliminary stages. But how about the merger of Union Pacific and Norfolk Southern?
Oh,
this is a connection of Union Pacific, which dominates the West, and then Norfolk Southern, which dominates a lot of the East, and there's a proposal to merge them. It's under review. It'll be 12 months or more in review, but that's an amazing opportunity for our state.
Yeah, and how does that...
It really connects the East and
West
Coast.
East and West,
Yeah, and so it makes freight more efficient. Salt Lake City's primary on the UP network. It'll make manufacturing better in our state. It'll get goods to market, help with it. Exports. Just
crossroads
stunning,
of the West.
Yeah, stunning.
Well, and this is one of the key things when it comes to rail. I mean, it's about freight. In the U.S., it's about
trucks
freight.
Off the road.
In,
love
in
that.
Other places, it's about moving people. But here, it's about freight.
Yeah. My understanding is in that merger that England Trucking and Swift Trucking all both support it.
Oh, wow.
Interestingly, because a lot of the trucking is the last mile, not the, you
not
know,
the long distance.
That's the interstate that we think about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You got an opportunity you want to shout out, John?
I guess I would just say as we're in the holiday season and sort of thinking about renewal for this new year, as frustrating as I think our current politics are, I guess I would just encourage people to stay engaged. I think it's really important that we continue to follow, to speak truth to power, to find ways to speak across the aisle and really see people in their full humanity and full value and not boil people down to just their politics.
Okay. That's a beautiful thought. Uplifting.
I'm going to say when we sit here and start valuing higher education, we have the opportunity to rethink how we deliver it, the cost effectiveness of it, the more dynamic nature of it that people will need to get reskilled over and over again as we move into a future of technology changing jobs and so forth.
That's fair. I can speak from the University of Utah in the sense that go to strategy.utah.edu and see the Impact 2030 strategy at the University of Utah, our flagship, and what we plan to do to re-engineer, reinvent higher ed for this state, be a model.
And I wish Utah would be the model to the nation.
We got 1 minute left on the program. I've got in my hand my big things for 2026, what I hope. I want us to be curious, not furious, regulate, then debate, listen to understand, not to respond, challenge ideas, don't attack people.
She's got all this written down.
Build up rather than tear down. What do you think?
I'm with you 100%.
This is what we call the skills for dignified disagreement, John.
And it's what we try and practice on this show.
It is.
Yeah, and I'll just take a second to thank our listeners. We're so grateful that you're with us. I'm sure many people are supporting public radio, making sure it's still here. But I just am grateful for the little community that this show has.
Yeah, and grateful to my two friends, John, Shireen. That's a wrap. Natalie Gochner, programs produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks, Shireen Gorbani and John Dougal, for all they do. Happy holidays, everyone.